From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ebola, the terrible hemorrhagic fever that drives so hard toward death, has emerged again, this time from a remote corner of the West African nation of Guinea. The death toll is already over 80. It's made it to Guinea's crowded capital city. That is unusual. Neighboring Senegal has closed its land borders. France is on alert for spread. Ebola kills. This hour on Point, the new Ebola outbreak. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen it? Seen a community in the grip of Ebola? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Conakry, the capital of Guinea in West Africa, is Misha Hussein, correspondent covering West and Central Africa for the Reuters news agency. His humanitarian reporting is funded by the Thomson Reuters Foundation. He's just back from Gekedu, the heart of the latest outbreak. Misha, we're glad you could make the time to join us. What's the situation in Guinea's capital now? How many deaths there? Has it spread, Misha?
Well, in the capital at the moment, we're still looking at four people who have died and a suspected 12 cases. The emphasis being on suspected. There is still shock that such a virus that's normally found in Central Africa in remote parts could have made it all the way over to the West, and that's now turning into fear and panic as we move along.
You've been out to the area of origin, or I guess about, 400 miles or so from Conakry. Where did this particular outbreak appear to begin and first spread?
Well, researchers are trying to look into that. The main priority at the moment is trying to heal people or trying to help them to get through the painful end stages of the infection. Eventually, though, we will start to look into the history of finding patient zero and trying to figure out where the source is. At the moment, researchers are pointing at fruit bats, which may have migrated across the continent, and that seems to be the most likely source. But, of course, people are not ruling out bushmeat, which includes bats or chimpanzees, antelopes, and things like that, which are very common on the African kind of continent.
Bat meat, I understand, is not an uncommon part of many Ghanaians' diet. Has that been banned? Are people still eating bat?
Bush meat has been banned, so that would include bat meat, definitely. Now, it has been forbidden by the government. Whether people are going to follow that, it remains to be seen. It's obviously a large part of the rural economy, and disseminating that information to many people who are illiterate as well, it may be too difficult for a West African state that perhaps doesn't have all those kinds of resources at hand.
What's known about how this may have traveled from Gekedu, where you've just been, to the capital city, Conakry, 2 million people on the coast? How would it have gone from one area to another?
It's believed that the cases that went to the capital was to do with a man who had been to a funeral. And he'd gone back to the capital, and he fell sick, and he entered a hospital. Now, normally this disease, when it's in the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example, it's in a remote location, and there isn't so much human-to-human contact. But there are two amplifiers for the virus, and one is funerals, and the other one is hospitals. And whenever a victim walks into a hospital or attends a funeral, there's a large chance that they're going to amplify the virus and give it to people and spread it that way. So, the number of cases are large, but they can be traced to not so many different families, if you like.
What's the total number of cases that have been fingered in Guinea at this point? 120, I'm reading, or more?
Yeah, I mean, in the whole region, we're looking at about 130, 135 cases. You know, you have about 14 in Liberia. Gambia are saying that there were two or three suspected cases there. We're hearing now that in Mali there's also cases. But again, we have to emphasize the word suspected here because the Ebola virus, when it starts in the initial stages, it can be mistaken for any number of things. It presents itself with flu-like symptoms. So it could be malaria, it could be typhoid, it could be the beginning stages of yellow fever or Lassa fever. So we will not know exactly how many people have been affected until much, much later.
How unusual is it, Misha, for this to be in a city of 2 million in Africa, for it to be in Conakry, the capital of Guinea?
I think it's... I wouldn't describe it as unusual. I think it's a little bit surprising that it managed to get all the way over from Central Africa, where it is endemic. It happens on an annual basis in parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Sudan. So it's a common thing that happens there. The surprising thing is that it managed to get over all the way to West Africa. And once it's there, because there's so much migration in this part of the world, especially through organizations like ECOWAS that allow people to go from country to country without visa, that's what's really brought it into the capital, I think.
I'm seeing reports here of cases now in Mali, inland, of course, from Guinea, Liberia. Senegal has closed its land border. That must be highly unusual.
Yeah, I believe, from what I understand, Senegal were advised by the WHO not to close their land borders because of the fear of spreading panic, which can be very damaging to the national economy. But nevertheless, they have done that. That's what they thought would be the best course of action. There is a fear that it will spread, but again, the countries that you mentioned, things like Sierra Leone, Mali, Gambia, these are all suspected cases at the moment, and they haven't been confirmed. So we have to wait to see if these really are Ebola cases or if they're not.
Misha, you described some sense of panic in the Ghanaian capital, Conakry. How is that manifesting itself? How are you seeing that?
Well, I think the most obvious thing for me when I touched down in Conakry a few days ago was this, you know, you can't shake anybody's hands. And that's very, very strange in a part of the world that really relies on handshakes as the kind of first interaction when you meet somebody new, you know. So that's very clear. There's a distance that's being kept between people. You see people wearing gloves. You see others who have got face masks on, and these are things that kind of you can see that manifest the panic.
And what about the care for those who have come down with Ebola in the capital? I mean, I see photographs here of those healthcare workers caring for them are wearing head-to-toe biohazard suits. Is that the only way to avoid potential infection?
When you're dealing with a victim at such close contact, and I'm sure the doctors that are going to be on the show will explain this in more detail, but when you're dealing with a patient at such close contact, that's the safest way to protect yourself. From what we understand, the Ebola virus is spread through contact with infected tissues, blood, secretions. So that's why they have that full protective clothing on. It isn't, however, spread through the air, so wearing things like face masks is going a little bit over the top. But again, that just kind of demonstrates the panic in the city, in Conakry, where people feel like they have to put on a face mask because they have no understanding of this virus.
And Misha, can you help us understand? Doctors Without Borders has described this as an unprecedented epidemic. The World Health Organization has been a bit more restrained in its description of what's going on with this Ebola outbreak. How do you make sense of the difference between those two characterizations?
I think it's quite simple. I think there's been a bit of misunderstanding. The Doctors Without Borders statement used a rather unfortunate word. They used the word unprecedented. And then they went on to say unprecedented geographically. That is to say that it's in many different locations, including a couple of major cities, one being Conakry that has 2 million people, you know, shacked up very closely together and poor sanitation. So it is unprecedented in terms of the geographical spread of the disease. However, it's not unprecedented in terms of the number of cases or the number of people who have died. We've seen much worse than that in 2003 in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and of course the very first outbreak in 1976. There were equally large number of cases. So I think the WHO's bone of contention is that they use the word unprecedented, and then this was picked up by the media and often referred to in terms of numerical precedence, but that's not the case.
Ebola definitely has people's attention moving into the capital city of Guinea, Conakry, city of 2 million on the coast of West Africa. Misha Hussain with Reuters, thank you for joining us from the Guinean capital today. Thank you very much, Misha.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the new Ebola outbreak in West Africa, into urban Africa now, in the capital of Guinea. It was a citizen of the capital city, Conakry. This was back in March, talking with E-News Channel Africa. Back then, Ebola had only shown up in the remote southeast corner of the country, part of the country perhaps as alien to him as to you and me. This citizen of Conakry, a city dweller, his greatest terror was that the disease would make it to the capital. And, of course, since he was interviewed in March, it has.
In Guinea, nothing works. There is trash everywhere. We don't know this disease. I think it comes from the forest. We must find a solution before it ends up in Conakry, because it is not good.
No, it is not good. Up to 90% death rate from Ebola. Here's a Ghanaian man, apparently resident of the capital, Conakry, talking with Reuters about the Ebola outbreak there. He's worried that the city's public health standards need to be improved to keep the disease in check. Interpreted here by Reuters.
We must clean up the city to fight against this disease. We must make sure of it, because everybody's afraid for their life.
And another Ghanaian here, a woman at an outdoor shop in the capital, Conakry, saying it's all about bleach now. Bleach.
I'm buying bleach because we heard that a disease has come into Guinea. So if we don't use bleach, it's not good for us. Everybody must use bleach in the house, for the toilets, to clean up in general.
An outbreak of Ebola in West Africa and into the capital city of Guinea, Conakry, 2 million there on the coast. With us right now from Houston, Texas, is Dr. Armand Sprecher. He is a Brussels-based public health specialist, an emergency physician, epidemiologist with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. He's a former member of the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service, and he's been in Houston at a big international conference on Ebola and other fluoroviruses, I guess in Galveston, this conference. Dr. Armand Sprecher, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here, Tom.
Can you just give us the basic first on Ebola? Are there different strains? Are some more deadly than others? What's the range, doctor?
There are several different species. The ones that tend to cause outbreaks are Ebola Zaire, Ebola Sudan, and Ebola Bundibugyo. And they do have different lethality. Ebola Sudan kills about half the people who get it, Bundibugyo a bit more than a third, and unfortunately Zaire can be up to 90%, which is what we're looking at right now.
Well, from what you're hearing from your distance, you say it is Zaire, the most deadly that we're looking at in Guinea.
Yes, that's correct.
And describe for us the process. If it's Ebola Zaire, how does one contract it? Once contracted, what is the likely course of the disease?
Well, the most common way one contracts it is taking care of somebody else who has the disease. The disease primarily affects caregivers because they're the ones who come into contact with infected body fluids. Unfortunately, a lot of the patients go on to die, and another good way to get the disease is to attend a funeral, because a lot of West African and Central African funeral rituals involve the touching of the corpse, and we've seen a lot of clusters of deaths amongst attendees of funerals. So that, unfortunately, is the hallmark of the disease. I mean, people in these regions die for a lot of reasons, but when we hear about clusters of funeral attendees and healthcare workers and family members attending their loved ones, that's the big red flag that makes us think of Ebola.
Death is painful by Ebola, high fever, severe headache, vomiting, diarrhea, profuse bleeding. It's called a hemorrhagic disease. What exactly does that mean, Dr. Sprecher?
Well, so it's amongst the group of diseases called hemorrhagic fevers, but despite the name, not everybody has bleeding, and when they do, it's not especially dramatic. Ebola tends to look like a very severe case of the flu. People get a bad fever, they sort of ache all over, they can become very weak and become bedbound, and then they have vomiting and diarrhea. Later in the disease, some of them will go on to have some bleeding around the gums, maybe from the nose, some blood in the vomit or diarrhea. And then, unfortunately, those who don't do well, which is a lot of them, go into a shock-like state and die. But it's not like it's portrayed in the movies.
How long does that death take from infection to death, typically, with the Zaire strain?
Well, from infection until the first signs of illness is usually 5 to 9 days. It can be as late as 21 or as quick as 2 or 3, but usually around a week. Once one is sick, 5 to 7 days is about how long the usual course of fatal illness goes. If you survive it, it takes a while to recover. People who survive this disease are rather beat up by it, and it takes a while for them to bounce back.
No doubt. France has alerted doctors to look out for any signs of Ebola coming in from West Africa. Of course, a lot of French colonies there and a lot of traffic between France and West Africa. With that 5 to 9 days period of infection, does it travel? Is there a pattern of this traveling even by air with infected folks moving internationally?
Well, in theory, it's possible. We don't see it often. We've seen it with some of the other hemorrhagic fevers. There was a case of Marburg hemorrhagic fever in Colorado not too long ago. Nobody knew it at the time. It was just diagnosed after the fact. Generally, if these diseases do reach North America or Europe, they don't go any further. Our hospitals in Europe and the United States have pretty good infection control, and that pretty much stops the disease. It is close contact with the sick people that transmits the disease, and we're pretty good about wearing gloves and masks and taking ordinary precautions, and that's probably enough most of the time.
This outbreak really has people's attention. Even in Saskatchewan, Canada, there was a fear last week that they had someone who'd just come back from Liberia, which borders Guinea, and concerned that he may have had Ebola. Talk to us about the origins for a moment here. I mean, we read that most of the outbreaks are thought to start when you've got hunters deep in the forest or jungle and eat the flesh of apes that died of Ebola. Is that what people typically mean when they say bush meat?
That's one form of bush meat. That's the one that we see most often in these outbreaks. The reservoir, at least of the other member of this family of viruses, Marburg, has been well demonstrated to be bats, and that's what we think about Ebola. That hasn't been proven yet. But at some point, the great apes come in contact with the reservoir, again, probably bats, and they become sick. And then hunters in the forest find a sick or dead ape, and that's free meat. And that gets brought back, and the people who come into contact with the ape before, before it's cooked, because once it's cooked, it's okay. But the people who come into contact with it before then become ill, and that's how the outbreak starts. And from after that point, it's human-to-human transmission.
I'm reading here in the New York Times that in West Africa, bats, fruit bats in particular, are a popular food, usually cooked in a peppery soup or smoked over a fire. If that meat is boiled, this report says it's presumably safe. Smoked meat could be dangerous. Butchering bats, if they're infected, certainly would be. And the headline here was that bat soup has been banned in Guinea. What about the direct consumption of potentially infected bats?
Well, that would allow people to skip a step, yeah. You don't have to go through the intermediate grade ape. And yes, that would certainly be high risk coming into contact with the bats. That being said, bats don't seem to get especially sick with the disease, so they probably don't have levels of virus that are quite as high as you would find them in the great apes. A dead great ape from who died from Ebola would be very infectious because it would become very sick and have a lot of virus, whereas bats, because they don't get so sick with this disease, are probably not as dangerous, but again, anything is a risk, and it doesn't take much of the virus if you get it into the right spot to start disease.
How do you handle it when this breaks out? I mean, in Guinea, of course, if you picture it, as you know, it kind of wraps around Sierra Leone with Conakry on the coast, and then in a kind of arc back into West Africa around Sierra Leone over toward Liberia. The original outbreak, kind of sort of the boondocks of Guinea, I think it's fair to say. Surely not many resources there. And that's where most of the death has occurred, of the 80 plus now. When you're in the boonies in Africa and this happens, how do you stop it? Because presumably people go to their loved ones to try to help them when they become sick, and then they must themselves become infected. How do you break that chain?
You need a lot of people with good shoes.
Meaning?
You have to go knocking on a lot of doors. Once you identify cases, the first thing you want to do is put them somewhere where they can be cared for safely. And you've seen the pictures of the people in the treatment wards. That prevents any further spread of the virus. But then you ask those people who are sick who they came into contact while they were sick out in the community. Then you have to run all these people down, find them, and visit them every day and say, are you sick today? How are you feeling? And you come back the next day and the day after, up until 3 weeks from the last point of contact. If at any point they become sick, you bring them back to the treatment unit and test them to make sure that it's not Ebola. And this will stop transmission, but it's a lot of footwork to go around and identify all of the contacts and visit them on a regular basis. And that's logistically challenging and requires a lot of manpower, but it's terribly effective once you get it done.
Here's the Ghanaian government spokesman, Damantang Albert Kamara, saying that authorities there will take every precaution to try to prevent the spread of Ebola.
To start with, we will increase the protection of all those in charge of the sick persons in Geketu, Masenta, with protection kits not only going to hospital employees, but also to the families. We will set up a surveillance perimeter in those zones and teach, make people understand the basic hygiene, consumption, food and material sharing precautions in order for the epidemic to be contained.
Ghanaian official there. Dr. Armin Sprecher, please stand by in Houston, Texas. I want to go to Copenhagen right now, if I may, and Dr. David Heyman. He's head of the Center on Global Health Security in London, professor of infectious disease epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. His fieldwork on Ebola goes back to the first recorded outbreak in Yambuku, Zaire in 1976. Dr. Heyman, thank you very much for joining us today. How do you characterize this latest outbreak, sir?
Well, thanks, Tom. This latest outbreak is one of the major outbreaks. There have actually been three major outbreaks before in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was formerly Zaire, and also in Uganda. And this will be a major outbreak, and unfortunately there will be people who die, and it will be a challenge to stop it from transmitting.
How unusual is it for it to come into an urban area the size of Conakry, 2 million people?
Well, this virus travels with people who are sick and seeking medical care many times, and this is not the first time that it's gone into a major urban area. In fact, a doctor who was treating patients in Gabon contracted the infection, became sick, and went to South Africa to a major hospital there. He was put in isolation. It wasn't known what he had. He was isolated. One of the nurses who was giving him intensive treatment became infected and died, but no one else was infected. The virus also traveled in a veterinarian to Zurich in Switzerland, where she was isolated with an unknown disease. That disease did not spread further because she was properly isolated, and a month after she recovered, the virus was identified in the blood that had been taken when she was sick. So it does travel to urban areas sometimes.
Dr. Heyman, you're in Copenhagen. Of course, there's quite a lot of traffic between West Africa and Europe. What is the risk of this jumping continents?
Well, it has jumped continents. As I said, it's gone into Zurich. And if it comes into a hospital in Europe, whatever it is, if it's a fever of unknown origin from any African country, it will certainly be taken care of properly. The patient will be isolated, and health workers will be careful until they know what the diagnosis is and how to best manage the patient. The MERS coronavirus, which is now in West Africa, has actually spread into many European countries, but because those countries are on the alert and isolate patients with fevers that they can't identify, it doesn't spread further.
Presumably, sophisticated hospitals have isolation wards. How do you both isolate and treat when this is in the field? Or is it kind of abandonment of patients because they're so lethal to their health care givers?
No, it's very important that patients be treated and managed. And what is done is one building is dedicated to sick patients. One building is dedicated to people who might have a fever, who have been in contact and who might be illness. And by isolating patients and keeping others out of those wards and making sure that the medical workers are protected, the disease can be stopped and stopped quite easily.
What's the trend line here? Africa's population grows. Does that mean the risk of Ebola grows with that population density?
As far as we understand, Ebola is a disease that occurs periodically in regional, in the non-urban areas of Africa. When it occurs, if it doesn't get in a hospital where practices are poor and can transmit the disease, it usually causes only a very small outbreak and then it stops. When it gets into a hospital, however, their health workers are at risk. They become infected many times if they're not practicing good precautions, and so do others who work in the hospital. And then the next in line is, unfortunately, numbers of those hospital workers, and then it spreads gradually into the community. Not much different than happened with SARS in industrialized countries.
What about the sociology of this? You've got the Liberian health minister reportedly this week warning people not to shake hands, not to kiss, not to have sex, because it's the exchange of fluid that transfers the disease. Do those recommendations make sense?
These are certainly recommendations that come from fear and from being extremely cautious, but these recommendations would be better aimed at staying away from people who are sick and making sure that those people get proper medical care and they're isolated appropriately. In other words, focus on those people who are sick and people who have had contact with them, because it's not until you're sick that you really can transmit this virus to others, and then it's only transmitted by close contact with a patient's blood or with body secretions, as you've heard earlier.
Dr. Sprecher in Houston, reports here of a kind of psychosis in the Ghanaian capital, psychosis just because of the intense fear of this. Have you seen that dynamic before?
Yeah, people fear.
Dr. Sprecher?
Yes, people do get understandably afraid, and they do engage in counterproductive behaviors. You played an audio a little bit earlier about a woman talking about the liberal use of bleach. And years ago in Uganda, we had stories of people who were injuring themselves drinking bleach because they thought it was a treatment for the disease or a preventive medicine. So we do have to pay very close attention to people's behaviors and make sure that the right right messages get out.
We're going to look in a moment at efforts to find a cure or some way of combating Ebola earlier in the process. Dr. David Heyman joining us today from Copenhagen at the Center on Global Health Security. Dr. Heyman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the new Ebola outbreak in West Africa, into urban Africa now, in the capital of Guinea, and taking its deadly toll there. 80-plus dead in this latest outbreak, 130-plus infected. It's the Zaire strain, a very deadly strain of Ebola, hemorrhagic fever. Dr. Armin Sprecher joins us from Houston, Texas. He's just been down in Galveston at a big conference on what's going on right now and beyond in this realm of medicine and disease. With us right now as well from Breckenridge, Colorado, is Dr. Erica Ullman-Sapphire, expert in hemorrhagic fevers, professor at the Department of Immunology and Microbial Science at the Scripps Research Institute, director of the Viral Hemorrhagic Fever Immunotherapeutic Consortium. It's an international effort to develop antibodies to diseases like Ebola. Dr. Sapphire, thank you very much for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
Is there a path toward a vaccine or a drug cure for Ebola?
Well, there's a lot of hope. There are a lot of good things which look good in test tubes and in research animals. So there's some hope that we should soon have something to offer for when this virus breaks out again.
We want to probe that. I've got a lot of questions lined up from our listeners. Stand by, Dr. Sapphire, Dr. Sprecher, Ted in Canton, Ohio. Ted, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Hey, how are you doing today?
Fine. What's your question, Ted?
I would just like to talk with, I'm a chef professionally. I've cooked a lot of animals, some strains. I've cooked a lot of seafood, a lot of land. With the, do they just eat the bat as in, they just boil it, or do they, how is it contracted from the bat? Is it because the bat is a dirty animal?
Dr. Sprecher, can you speak to that? Do you have enough experience in West Africa where bat is on the menu to speak to how it's prepared and what difference, you know, how it comes through?
Well, first off, I'm not a good cook, so how it exactly is prepared, I can't tell you. But when you have a bat and you cut the animal in preparing it, you're going to expose yourself to the bat's blood and body fluids. If you have a break in the skin on the hands, which is very common, you have a hangnail or a bit of open skin somewhere, the virus has a port of entry, and that would be the easiest way to do it. The next thing that you would do is if you have the bat's blood on your hands, if you were to wipe your face, get your fingers anywhere near your mouth or nose or eyes, that would be another good way to bring the virus into your system. So just the handling of infected meat is a high-risk procedure. Now, if everybody were wearing just a simple pair of gloves or they were washing their hands and they didn't have broken skin, it might be okay. But you don't want to take a chance and say might with a disease like Ebola.
A peppery soup or smoked over a fire is the reporting out of Guinea on this, Ted. I appreciate your call. Dr. Sapphire, what about in your research? Are you looking at host animals that have been most associated with Ebola, at apes or bats, and how they host the disease?
Well, to some degree, mainly I'm a molecular biologist, and so I look at the particular parts of the virus and what their surfaces and shapes are like. And then by looking at that, we get a roadmap of where you'd want to target a drug or an antibody. So that's more of the line of my research. Eventually, that goes into animals to see if it works. But I'm more of an expert in why the virus is pathogenic and how it functions.
Now, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the U.S. military is at least in part funding your research. Why? Because they're afraid they may be deployed in areas where there's Ebola? Because they're afraid Ebola might at some point be weaponized?
Well, my research is actually funded by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. But I do have Army scientists on my team, and it's because the Army has the special facilities. They're called Biosafety Level 4 labs. These are the spacesuit labs where the scientists can do the work with live Ebola virus to understand what treatments are going to work and which will not work and why.
And what is the military's particular interest in this?
Well, they have a couple. So they want to provide things for general public health and good. Of course, the military could be deployed to these areas. But I think the most likely use of this would be in healthcare settings in Africa where there are natural outbreaks, or in doctors that are flying out there to help and try to contain the outbreak, and in scientists that work with this virus themselves, whether that's in the United States, Europe, or in Africa.
So you're talking about giving them some kind of shot before they come into an area where they fear they might be exposed?
Well, that's one possibility. So what our big consortium does, we've recently discovered that antibodies, these are molecules that your immune system makes in response to a pathogen. An antibody would be the end point of a vaccine. So if you give somebody a vaccine against measles, your body would raise antibodies against measles, and they would help you clear a measles infection if you ever encountered one. So vaccines are great, but they can take a couple of weeks to give you that immunity.
Right.
For something like Ebola, you don't have that much time. You want to give somebody immunity immediately. And so what we found is if we can purify the right antibodies, you could give them to somebody 24 or 48 hours after infection, or even, why not, before infection, if you know that Ebola cases are coming into this hospital and there are healthcare workers that have a high likelihood of being exposed, I don't see why you couldn't give them what's called prophylactic immunity, so pre-immunity before doing the work. So there are a lot of opportunities to try to help.
Ebola works awfully fast. You've got to develop something that would be almost immediately effective.
Yes. Well, the studies in animals suggest that the antibodies are effective 24 or 48 hours after exposure. So they would give the animal a lethal dose of the virus and then the antibody a day or 2 days later, and that seems to work. And so the really exciting thing about that finding is that within 24 to 48 hours, you have a practical time window by which the treatment could be flown to the patient or the patient could be brought to the treatment.
Let's go to Owen in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Owen, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm enjoying the show.
Good.
I had a statement for the first guest that you had on. He said that it was over the top to wear the face mask. And even though this pathogen is not in the air, but you do wear the face mask to protect yourself from projectile fluids like coughing or sneezing or even vomiting. So it's not over the top. It's basically standard.
Yeah, I'm looking at photographs to hear that would bear that observation out, Owen. Dr. Sprecher in Houston, this looks like an awfully hot get-up in equatorial Africa, but I'm looking at people here carrying, it looks like Ebola victims, and they are head-to-toe, practically a kind of hazmat suit outfit.
Yeah, and that's a reflection of, one, the low tolerance for error. You don't want to get, you know, Ebola in the wrong place because we just don't have a lot of good options if you get it. So people are working very hard to minimize the risk. And I think when Erica's medicines become available, we will all breathe a sigh of relief and maybe dial it back a bit. And the other thing is that it's very easy to always put on more. Ebola generates a lot of fear and things have ratcheted up over time. And we probably have to pull back a little bit to something that is sufficient but not over the top, as was said earlier, because you're right, it's quite hot. They can wear those outfits for about 30 or 40 minutes before they have to take them off. Something that's a little bit lighter and more breathable would be something you could wear a bit longer.
Have you worked in a so-called hot zone, Dr. Sprecher? And how close have you been to Ebola patients?
No, I've treated Ebola patients. It's been a while. I was an isolation ward doctor in the outbreak in Gulu, Uganda back in 2000. But they've sort of moved me on to coordination positions, so I don't put on the gloves anymore.
I mean, is that an undertaking that leaves you in a state of constant mortal fear?
Well, it evolves. It's like any exposure to risk. You are probably the most scared early on, and fear at that point is probably counterproductive. As time goes by, you learn to become used to the environment. You still do things with great caution. There is nothing that focuses the mind like holding a sharp needle to draw blood from a patient with Ebola, because you really don't want to slip with that needle. And then as time goes by, it becomes a bit more usual. And I think we've said for a long time that after people have been working for 3 or 4 weeks in this environment, maybe it's time to get them out because maybe they've gotten too comfortable. So there's a window in there when you're most productive.
You know, I don't know if it's just how it moved into popular consciousness, but we think of death by Ebola as one of the worst ways to go. Have you seen that borne out, Dr. Sprecher?
Well, yes, I've seen people die of Ebola, and it's not pleasant. But, you know, there are a lot of unpleasant diseases out there. The popular imagination doesn't coincide completely with reality. I mean, anybody who's seen somebody die of rabies would say that has to be one of the worst ways to go. But we don't have a cultural fear of rabies like we do of Ebola. So there's got to be something more to it than that.
Well, we certainly once did when it was more common. Adam in Fairhaven, Vermont. Adam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think?
I'd like to know the likelihood that the Ebola virus is going to spread to the United States.
Let me bring that first to you, Dr. Sapphire. What about the spread? Have you looked at that, the potential?
Most of the Ebola patients are too sick to travel. There's certainly a possibility that somebody could get on a plane and get here. But fortunately, we have very good medical care in the United States, and barrier nursing is standard. What I mean by barrier nursing are gloves and masks and things to control infection. So I think that even if an Ebola patient did come here, the cases would be isolated to maybe their immediate family before they got to the hospital and then the hospital. And I think we have very good epidemic intelligence here so that it would be contained. So it wouldn't be the Hollywood spread across the country scenario.
Dr. Sprecher, do you agree?
Yeah, and that's been borne out. I mean, people who've come with other filovirus diseases to the United States, which has happened at least once, don't spread it to anyone else. The normal healthcare process takes care of it. And importantly, this is not a disease that one spreads before one becomes sick. So people who are not yet ill do not spread the virus to people next to them. So that is another reason that this doesn't get passed around very easily.
Let's go to Dave in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to say, this is Ebola that came out of the Kinema Caves in, near Congo there, and they said it traveled to, it did come to the United States in some lab monkeys, and was in, like, West Virginia or Virginia, and one of the doctors over there, I think, got, the CDC got contaminated from this.
Dave, your line's a little rough, but I think I got the gist of that. Dr. Sprecher, has it in the past made its way to the United States in lab monkeys, West Virginia?
There was an outbreak in animals that were brought here for laboratory research that was in Reston, Virginia, mm-hmm. and that was the subject of the well-known book, The Hot Zone, which probably contributes to our cultural fascination with this disease. Nobody became sick as a consequence of that. It appears that human beings do not get sick with Ebola Reston, which is a different species than Ebola Zaire.
We've got the CDC. I'm reading a report here from just yesterday, I guess, sending a 5-person team to West Africa right now, to Guinea and beyond. What will their interest be in being on the scene, Dr. Sprecher? Is this an advance party to make sure it does not come here or to track it, or are they simply trying to learn more about it? What would they be doing?
Well, that team that's going for the CDC is mostly going to do epidemiologic work. So they will be doing much of what's going on right now. They will be investigating each case to identify how the person became sick, helping out with the identification of contacts and the contact tracing. And I believe they're also bringing along with them a piece of software they're developing that is designed to help manage outbreaks. It just helps you keep track of cases and contacts in a way that facilitates their management.
Dr. Sapphire, in Colorado, you've done a lot of research on this. You're a molecular biologist. When you look at Ebola, let's say a fierce strain, Ebola Zaire, under the microscope, is it immediately obvious to you that you've got something particularly deadly on your hands from the structure, the molecular structure that you observe?
Well, it only looks deadly because we know what Ebola looks like. And mm-hmm. so if we see something that looks like Ebola, we get quite concerned. So viruses come in all different shapes and sizes. So some are shaped like geometric icosahedra. Some are little balls. Ebola is a long filament, like a wiggly piece of yarn.
Mm-hmm.
And so that shape makes us nervous because if we see that, we think filovirus. When the virus is very clever. So the human genome has 20 or 25,000 genes. And so we make 20 or 25,000 different kinds of molecules for all different kinds of functions.
Mm-hmm.
But this virus only has 7 genes. And so it's quite lean and mean. It does a lot with each molecule that makes. And when you look at the structure of the molecules, you can see how it covers itself in human carbohydrate to be like a wolf in sheep's clothing. So your immune system doesn't see much of its surface. And so what we're trying to do are find those parts that aren't covered where we can target the antibodies.
Is it so deadly to humans because it has spent most of its evolutionary life in apes and we're close to apes?
Well, there is some thought, and you know, a successful virus is one that doesn't really make its host very sick, so that host could walk around and spread it, kind of like the common cold.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, Ebola virus must be new to humans because it kills us so quickly that we can't spread it as quickly as we could the common cold. Armand could probably answer that question better than I could.
Armand, how about it? Is the ape connection somehow make this particularly lethal to humans?
Well, I think it's probably the bat connection. There are some viruses that
exist in bats that they live with quite well that are rather nasty for humans. And Ebola, assuming that that's, we prove that it's in bats, we know that its cousin Marburg is one of them, but there are other ones. There's bat-borne rabies, there's bat-borne Nipah virus, all of which are especially unpleasant for humans. It works both ways, by the way. There are diseases that humans have that do awful things to animals, and Eric is right. Something that is well adapted for its host doesn't do much damage to its host, but when it gets into an animal for which it's not well adapted, it can be rather destructive.
Dr. Sefar, are you close? Might you have a syringe full of something within a few years that would be an antidote?
Within a few years, I think so. So there are some candidate antibodies that look great in the lab studies, and they're heading towards FDA approval. I'm not quite sure where we are in that process because the other scientists are working on that part of it. But I think within a few years, we're going to do it. What we've done now is put together a global consortium of about every scientist in the field. We're all putting our resources together to try to solve the problem.
Well, our best hopes for Guinea right now, where they're really wrestling with this, both in the countryside and in the capital city of Conakry. Dr. Eric Ullman-Sapphire, we thank you for your insights today on Ebola. Thank you very much for joining us from Breckenridge, Colorado.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Armin Sprecher in Houston, Texas, thank you very much for being with us today, Dr. Sprecher.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.